Ahoy there, and welcome to Sea Views, where we talk about the big issues in maritime. It's a really sad fact that we lose one seafarer every day. And there are estimates we're losing a fisherman every 5 minutes. I'm Julia Gosling. I've worked in maritime safety and search and rescue for 20 years, and I've met some truly inspiring people. I want you to meet them too. Can we all make some changes that will make the workplace at sea a safer place? Welcome, everybody. I'm delighted to have with me today Captain Andrew Moll, who's Chief Inspector at the UK Government's Marine Accident Investigation Branch and at the sharp end of investigating accidents at sea. And we're also joined by Ari Palmers, and you're at the even sharper end as a practitioner, and you're a senior maritime pilot in the Netherlands. And I also have Adam from Chirp. Welcome again, Adam.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to have you all with me, and we're going to be talking about marine pilot safety. I'm wondering, Ari, if I could start with you. Most of my listeners would be maritime professionals and they would be aware of what a maritime pilot does. But I do also have some listeners who are interested in maritime, but perhaps not professionals. Could you give me a little bit of an outline of your job? It's quite an exciting job, isn't it, in maritime?
Oh, yeah, of course it is, Julia. You cannot expect from every captain that he knows all the ins and outs of every port where he comes with a vessel. And that's where the pilot comes in. And at a safe distance from the shore, in open sea, they board the vessel and assist the captain and the bridge team to bring the ship safely in or out when he's departing from the port. That's basically what we do.
And the risk bit comes in because after, I don't know how many years, it hasn't changed that much. You still basically go up a ladder, don't you?
Yeah, we do it the same way as they did in the 1600s. And the most dangerous part of our job is getting to work. If you commute to an office, the biggest risk is that you get hit by a car or by a bus. We have to climb ladders. And every year accidents happen. A lot of accidents happen. So far this year, already 7 people being involved in the process of pilot transfers. So 7. And it's only June.
Yeah, it's too high, isn't it? Thank you, Ari. Andrew, you are at the sharp end of investigating accidents at sea at the Marine Accident Investigation Branch. Do you want to just give me a little outline of your role as well?
Yeah, certainly. So we investigate marine accidents to try and find what went wrong, come up with some safety lessons that we can then promulgate to industry or to specific companies or organisations that will help try and prevent accidents in the future. We do tend to be driven by outcomes. So something called a very serious marine casualty, the loss of a ship, death during an accident, or serious marine pollution is something that we will have to focus on. And to an extent, that does limit our ability to look elsewhere at the near misses and so on. But in terms of pilot safety, that is particularly something that we have been focusing on over the last couple of years.
Thank you. And Adam, you're also in the same realm, really, as Andrew, aren't you? Because, again, you're looking at the reports of accidents and trying to get insight from those.
We do, but in a very different way. We are just a maritime safety charity. We are very much at the near-miss end of the spectrum. So almost the other end to Andrew, as he was speaking about, where he has much more of a sort of statutory duty to investigate. We are a voluntary reporting system. That being said, we do often talk about the same issues, and certainly all three of us, I think, regularly talk about the dangers pilots face and the incidents and accidents that occur, tragically.
Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to talk about the risk for maritime pilots and where we're at. And Ari, you already mentioned 7 fatalities this year. Do you want to start us off with your thoughts about that, and Andrew and Adam as well?
Yeah, it's the most dangerous part of our job, trying to get there. And if you look at how many pilot transfers there are executed every day of the week, every week of the year, statistically, chances of you getting into an accident are not very high. But the problem with statistics is always, it's a bummer when it's you. And most of these accidents, they're all preventable because it's not rocket science. It's just some pieces of wood and some rope. That's it. And there's some rules how to secure it. And still it goes wrong all the time.
What is happening with the rate of accidents? Is it going up? Is it stabilized? I mean, obviously, we agree it's too high.
Yeah, if you look at the IMPA figures and you compare them over the last few years, numbers are going slightly up in non-compliancy. That's maybe also possible because there's more awareness at the moment. People are paying slightly more attention than in the past. But overall, the numbers are not going down, and that's a pity.
And that's not for want of trying, is it, Ari? I mean, there's been a lot of focus on pilot ladders over the last few years.
Yeah, but still things go wrong. And a lot of it has to do with training and explaining, because I redirected a book for the Naval Academy, or a guy who writes books for Naval Academies. And in the entire book, there was only 2 pages about pilot transfer arrangements, because nothing is educated at school about it, just the 2 pages. And they will say, you will learn on board. But eventually, there will be nobody left on board to teach you how to do it right, because nobody knows it anymore. That's why my focus is a lot on training and explaining.
Yeah, the training and explaining. Andrew, could you come in on this?
Yeah, sure. Conferences back in 2021, UK Maritime Pilots Association, British Ports Group, Port Skills and Safety and so on. And the theme of pilot transfers came up loud and clear. There was a big concern about it, but no one seemed to have the data. So throughout the whole of last year, we collected data and we asked people to talk to us about the accidents they'd had or indeed the non-conformities. And we had over 200 reports came into the MEIB. So we thought, well, that's 200 of how many? What have we got? Went out to the UK industry. We canvassed 105 competent harbour authorities representing about 700 marine pilots. And we established that about 96,000 transfers occurred in the UK last year. So a lot of transfers. And collectively, they got about 400 incidents and non-conformities. So we got about half of those reported to us, which was fascinating stuff. And we were able to sort of devil into that. As Ari says, by far the biggest risk or the biggest thing that we're finding is non-conforming pilot ladders. So these are ones which have got an inherent risk to them. They're deficient or defective in some way. Touch wood, the number of accidents we're having is pretty few, but when they do occur, and I'm sure we'll come on to that, they can be pretty nasty. And when we started to break it down by type of vessel and what sort of things were common non-conformities, and I've got all that data as well, it's too dull to read it out here. But what is interesting is that we've done a quick check on the first 6 months of this year, or the first 5 and a bit months, and we're getting exactly the same pattern as we did last year. So last year was not anomalous so far. What is happening is continuing to happen.
Yeah, so the rate of accidents doesn't necessarily seem to be going down then.
No, not at all.
No, okay. I'm also think we should dig into this issue of what is reported and what isn't. I mean, Andrew, you just identified that you found that at least 50% of incidents weren't actually coming up in your reports, were they? So is that the tip of the iceberg? I mean, is there, and Ari, you would say that when you're out actually going onto vessels, you are seeing the non-compliance is actually a lot higher than what is reported or found.
Yes, it is. Since 2018, so that's 5 years and a bit at the moment, I've been keeping a tally for myself. And it's around about 57% of pilot transfer arrangements I see in front of me on a daily basis are in one way or the other way non-compliant.
Yeah, so that's and basically that's very one high. In two. And also, it's quite a different number to when you look at any of the surveys, for example, IMPA, which has something like 16%, is it, from 2022 as non-compliant setup. So that means that really at the sharp end where it's actually happening on vessels, it's worse than perhaps we would know officially, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think the good news is for me, particularly here in the UK, is that there's a really strong focus on this now. People are beginning to realise that they need to report it. They need to capture the data. There's a good app which you can use, which pilots are all being encouraged to use to report this stuff. So the data is beginning to flow in and the focus is beginning to come on the problem.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. And actually, looking even more widely, I would say almost half of all the reports that we get in CHIRP come from pilots.
Okay, that's good, isn't it, in terms of the reporting? If it's becoming less acceptable to just take the risk and get on with it, and that's perhaps not as acceptable as it used to be for professionals working in this industry.
Yeah, I agree. But I tell you what, there's one thing we haven't quite touched on, just I think for your listeners, Julia, and Ari can probably cover this much better than I can. And that is that a non-compliance almost is a poor term because it's quite a fluffy name. You know, a non-compliance, it just sounds like I haven't quite got enough air in my tyres and I just need to go to the garage and, you know, put a bit more air in. It sounds like it's not dangerous, but a non-compliant ladder is actually an inherently dangerous ladder. And I can see Ari nodding his head there very vigorously. You know, and that's the point that I think a lot of people overlook. When they hear about it's a non-compliant ladder, it sounds a bit like, oh, you haven't ticked the right box in some paperwork. But what it means is that actually, potentially, it means it'll be attached correctly. And therefore, or it might be attached in a way that actually makes it difficult to climb or more likely that somebody's going to fall off of it.
Yeah, that's on our Facebook page, Dangerous Ladders. We always state, if it's non-compliant, it's dangerous, don't use it.
Mm. And actually, Ari, I think that's a really good point, because one of the things that we in Chirp say to people, you know, if it's dangerous, don't climb it. And we use the term, you know, stop work authority. And actually, I'd love to understand why is the pilots still climb ladders that they know are dangerous. And there's so many reports that I get, you know, and they're formatted and they say, was the ladder compliant? No. Did you climb it anyway? Yes. And I often wonder, well, why did you climb that ladder if you knew it was non-compliant?
Yeah, that's true. And most of the non-compliances or non-conformities, they're easy fixes. You can shout up and then they will fix it for you. But sometimes it has to do with the way the ladder is secured to deck. And then you have used a non-compliant system. But you only find out when you get to the deck.
Now, is that because ladders need to be attached and the way that they're attached differs by individual ship or by class, or is it by regulatory sort of area?
Well, the point is that nowhere in the rules it is mentioned how a ladder should be secured to deck. Only in the IMO 8.1045 chapter 7 side doors is something said about securing of pilot ladders to strong points. That's the only time. There's about 11 different rule books. Evan Rattray from Aberdeen, he wrote a really good paper on it, Snakes or Ladders, and the difference in rules, and sometimes they're even contradictory, doesn't make it easier for ship crews to do it right.
No, so this issue of different rules, older ships have different rules applied to them, don't they? Is this something for the future, and probably already working on it, Ari, I don't know, but is this something that can be synchronized in some way or rationalized to make one set of rules?
Absolutely. And that's what they've been talking about in London a couple of weeks ago at NCSR 10, the IMO Subcommittee on Navigation, Communication, Search and Rescue. One of the big topics over there was pilot transfer arrangements and the regulations around it. Because a lot of it is mentioned in footnotes in SOLAS, and footnotes are not law. They're just extra. So now it has to be lifted out of the footnotes, making the IMO and the ISO 799. But on the other hand, a good friend of mine, Kevin Valens, he always says, with the present rules, 50% of the ships is non-compliant. What makes you believe that with new rules, they will be compliant? But at least it will be easier to enforce or point out, because the IMO resolutions, they're not requirements, they're recommendations. And that's also an issue. Basically, in the IMO resolutions, it's stated that the bottom four steps of a pilot ladder should be made of rubber or any other material with equivalent strength. But it's not in the law. So if you have four wooden steps at the bottom, basically, according to SOLAS, it can be all right. According to ISO and IMO, it's not. So that's difficult.
Yeah, and we know that compliance is always going to be more likely if it's clear what should be complied with. So it's obvious it's not helping. Andrew, do you have any thoughts on the different rules and regulations that apply to the pilot ladder arrangements?
Yes, I mean, I think that there is a wide range of rules. It's not particularly clear, isn't helpful. That's not a good starting point. And it's not a good starting point because someone who is approaching the problem from a compliance-based approach, I will do the minimum to comply and that's all, is going to find a set of rules that ticks their box and that's going to be where they stop. We do try to get rules amended and so on. It can be quite a protracted process. You've quite often got to have a serious accident, very serious accident, a death or more, to get something, to get to the IMO, to get to a working group to be discussed for a new code of practice or circular to be created. In the meantime, accidents can still happen. So the best thing to do is actually try and change people's mindset to it, and that's to own the problem. And I think that's where we're going at the moment. There's some cracking videos out on YouTube about pilot boarding safety. The French Maritime Pilots Association have just done a good one. But if you can get people locally to own the problem, then they can start giving local solutions to local problems. And if I give you just a couple of examples. So if at the port stage, thinking about the port, the pilot boat, the transfer out and so on, we're seeing huge diversions in, is there a spare member of crew to go out on the pilot deck to help the pilot get on board or not? Does the pilot boat move clear once the pilot's on the ladder? Some do, some don't. Is there a systematic process for assessing the ladder that you can see before you start to board? Is there a line to take the pilot's bag so he doesn't have to have it in his bag? These are things that can be tackled locally and can make an improvement. And the same is true for ships, you know, making sure that officers take an interest in the arrangements, they monitor the transfer and so on. So if we can get people locally to start taking the problem seriously, that will be a really good start.
Yeah. Okay. Because criminalising things or regulating things can only go so far. I mean, as Ari said, there are regulations there, whether or not everybody's following all of them. They are there. And actually, there's still a lot of non-compliance. And I think it brings us on to this question about the carrot and the stick, regulations versus education. And it must be a combination, mustn't it? And Ari, you work quite a lot in this, don't you, in terms of trying to educate? And I know that recently you've had, and others in your field, lots of success in terms of getting the message wider using social media, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. That works. That works very good to reach a bigger audience. The Facebook page, Dangerous Ladders, or I also put all the ships that I pilot every week on my LinkedIn page. I call that the weekly ladder misery. And then I point out the dangers of the non-compliant ladders, and the vessels that show up with a good system, I commend them and put their name of the vessel also in my post. But with the bad ones, I don't put names, because then it's start pointing fingers, and that's absolutely not what I'm after.
No, and that's not necessarily what gets the best outcome, is it? But I also do really like the fact that you do highlight the good ones, and that's great as well, that positive pride in somebody's work, that they've done it right.
Yeah, because I'm also convinced that every tries to do it, her or his job to their best ability, and then it all comes to a bit of training. Yeah, when you're on a ship, you have to work at what you're supplied with. If the vessel is, they call it, non-compliant by design, then it's difficult to work around, because then you start off on a bad note already. And then you have to try to get it right. And that's something that ship crews are also facing.
Yeah, and can we talk about these barriers to improvements? What are the reasons that vessels aren't improving the arrangements?
Well, yeah, a lot of pilots climb the ladder no matter what, because they can think, yeah, I had the same vessel last week. It would be stupid to tell the captain this time that it's not okay. Or some might think, well, it's 3 a.m. If I reject now, I kick myself back 3 hours. There are all sorts of reasons. And we've all been captains and mates. So we feel a connection with the ships. And you don't want to put a ship in a bad daylight. You don't want to bash them. You want to train them. But yeah, we as pilots, we're certainly part of the problem.
But, you know, on the bridge, and actually the master of the vessel, he or she should, I would have thought, had respect for a pilot coming on board. You know, that you're at the same level. You both could be doing the same job. Is it a problem at that level, or is it that there's a disconnect with what the crew on deck are doing? Or where do you feel a lot of these issues come from?
No, because when I talk to a captain about it, not at first instance when I reach the bridge, because I have a job to do first, and somewhere along the way, I'll bring it to his attention and show my photos, because after all, this captain could be a pilot a few years later and facing the same issues that I do. But yeah, it's difficult for him to check in person the ladder. That's what his officers have to do. And now, together with IMPA, we're working in a work group on a new poster because in the rules, there's also something mentioned called the responsible officer, as mentioned in the regulations. But his tasks and responsibilities are not mentioned in the regulations. So in the new poster, there will be a panel explaining the tasks and responsibilities from the responsible officer to help them to see what they have to do as being a responsible officer. It's not just ticking boxes on a checklist, because some checklists come with tick boxes out of the printer, but they have to inspect and check on a regular basis. That's also part of the ISO 799. There's also chapter 2 is about inspections of ladders and maintenance. So that was never mentioned in any rule.
Yep, clearer instructions to make it easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask something. I don't know if I can find it in the data, but are there more accidents when you're getting on board a vessel in general than when you are leaving? Because I assume as you're getting on the vessel, you can't actually see, for example, what's at the top. Whereas when you leave, you can assess the arrangements more easily. Does anyone know? I don't know if Andrew, you know in the data at all.
So the short answer from our very limited data trawl of the last sort of 18 months, but also looking back through accidents, is that yes, getting on board is more hazardous than getting off. Why is that? Well, I think a number of reasons. The first one is that there's less time for the pilot to assess the setup. When they're disembarking, they can go down, they can look, see how the ladder is secured and all the other bits and pieces before they start the disembarkation process. And also they've been at sea, they know the conditions and so on. So that's one reason. The other thing, though, is that if you divide the transfer into three parts, there's boat to ladder, climb the ladder, getting from the ladder to getting inboard. That is the top bit, getting from the ladder into the ship, is where MEIB's data would indicate that most of the accidents are happening. The accidents which are resulting in, you know, falls, which have the consequence of, you know, injury, disablement or death. And it's largely to do with the arrangements on the deck at the top of the ladder. Can the pilot grab suitable stanchions? Are they the right distance apart? Are they too narrow or too big to grip properly? Are they the right height so they can transition inboard? There's a whole bunch of stuff, and Harry could probably talk much better from experience than I can, about the transition from the ladder to the deck. Statistically, that's where we're seeing most accidents.
Yeah, that's true. Stanchion is also a big issue. A while ago, I came across a new built vessel. I won't mention the name because that's not important. And the minimum diameter of stanchions is mentioned at 32 millimeters. There's no maximum diameter at the moment in the regulations, because we all think, well, nobody would be so stupid to make lamppost size stanchions. Well, they are. And I came across this new built vessel. The stanchions were so thick, I couldn't get my hand around it. So now in the poster, we're making a new requirement as being the maximum diameter 36. So then I contacted the CEO of this company, and I told him, port state control reports already. So then we worked out a way to get the stanchions. It came fresh from the shipyard, all the certificates, everything, it was wrong. And that's basically what happens. When the entire chain fails, then the pilot is confronted with a non-compliant and therefore dangerous pilot transfer system. Handled stanchions is one of the causes of accidents. If you want to grab something in the dark, snow passing horizontally, and you grab and there's nothing there, you plummet back down.
Which sort of takes us back full circle, Julius, the issue of compliance, because the flag states and the classification societies are assessing against a standard which is laid down. If that standard doesn't have the right detail in it, then they can pass something as compliant because the standard doesn't tell them it isn't. So having said, as I did earlier, that, you know, owning the problem locally is a great start, it doesn't alter the fact, as Aris pointed out, that we ultimately have got to get the rules and regulations right, so that right from the get-go of building the ship, the standards are appropriate, the ship is constructed effectively, then we've got at least a half a chance that 5 years into its life, it's still going to be a compliant and effective boarding arrangement.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I'd like to follow up on that because, you know, we've touched on many of these things that are causing issues already, but poor design was mentioned earlier, and Ari's told you about stanchions, but from reports that we get at CHIRP, actually, the hull form is also, a lot of people are making these sort of V-shaped hulls now, I suspect, because it makes it more fuel efficient, and therefore, you know, on paper, it's fewer carbon emissions and a more sustainable vessel. But of course, you can't rig a ladder on the side of effectively an overhang. But of course, if you, as a pilot, pull up against a vessel and say, hey, you know, I can't climb this ladder because your hull's the wrong shape, there's actually very little, practically nothing, that the people on board or even a dry dock can do about it without effectively rebuilding the entire ship. So that's been built into that ship then for its entire service life, unless somebody can come up with a different way of getting a pilot on board, which, you know, as we've said, you know, there aren't that many ways.
Some ports use helicopters.
Yeah.
A lot of ports, they don't have access to helicopters, so then they depend on the shape of the hull. We've had some vessels, and they were deemed by us as being non-compliant to board. So then we have to order for a helicopter and board that way. That's the other option. But after that, there's nothing more you can do. That's the only other option.
Yeah.
Do you have access to helicopters at your port, Ari? Because it's not that many ports that use them, is it?
No, in Rotterdam and IJmuiden, Amsterdam, they use helicopters on a daily basis. We, in the south of the Netherlands, use them only for some special type of vessel. So we have to pre-order the helicopter. But it's not common practice for us to use helicopters.
And that's not quick. And of course, being in a helicopter overseas, especially at night, brings challenges and safety issues of its own. Trying to board a vessel, and I've done it in a past life in the Royal Navy, trying to climb onto vessels from a helicopter, I mean, that's quite a difficult thing to do. So there are no easy panacea. There's no one single panacea. There's lots of little things that we all have to do.
So looking at the education side of things, what is the future? How can you get some of this knowledge and information? How can we get it out there more widely? Does it have to be embedded into training, or is it just a case of educating more companies and more crew about this?
Well, that's what I do. I do whenever a shipping company or an organization's asked me for assistance or help, I'm always willing, no problem.
Brilliant. That would be straight from the horse's mouth, literally.
I think one of the important things, Julia, is to try and make sure that the messaging is as consistent as possible. And this is where getting the big organisations together to talk to each other to make sure that the messaging that they're putting out is as far as possible the same. And Ari made the point about the bottom four steps of the ladder. Should they be rubber or could they be wooden? Well, I think we would all recognise that rubber is what the bottom four steps ought to be, and then the fifth one, the spreader. But let's write that down and make sure that everyone is pushing that message out. Eventually, it will get up to the IMO and we'll get the regulations changed so that comes down from the top as well. But if from the bottom we're talking consistently, then I think that's a really good start. So this conversation today actually is all part of it. But the more we can unify our messaging to simplify it for the audience, the more readily they'll accept it.
Yeah. Regulation is a part of it, isn't it? It could be a deterrent. What are your thoughts in terms of prosecutions? It doesn't happen that often, does it?
No, I always try to solve the problem myself on board or in the port. Last year, I rejected a vessel to sail her from the berth. A message I got from that shipping company was that a message stating that they will hold the servicing pilot liable for all costs and delay. And I was like, okay, try me. But then it was a non-compliant trapdoor, better known official name, embarkation platform. And the ladder was suspended under the platform instead of running through the platform. That rule has been enforced since 2012. And those illegal trapdoors have been banned by the IMO in 1979 in 8.426. But they're still around, because of some grandfathering clause embedded in SOLAS, that vessels built before 2012 do not have to comply with the rules made after 2012, which is a silly excuse not to be safe, of course. But then the crew got to work, and then a couple of hours later, the system changed. It was compliant, and then the vessel sailed.
Yeah, and hopefully they then had that training and understanding for the next pilot. So you're doing them a favour as well, aren't you, every time you do that?
Yeah, that's what you always have to think about, the pilot that will come in the next port when you're gone. Because then if I say nothing, he has to face the same arrangement as I do.
Would some pilots feel that commercial pressure from their employer? I mean, obviously not your employer, RE, but they're obviously very supportive and have a good safety culture. But is that what's happening? Are a lot of pilots maybe feeling they can't use this stop work principle?
No, I don't think so, because every pilot has a fundamental right to reject, to bring himself into danger. Then maybe some mental pressure in your mind that you have to get the job done, but first it has to be safe, and then we do the job. I can't speak for other associations in other countries. I don't know all the regulations over there.
But I think that stop work principle is important, isn't it? Because it's not just for yourself, it's for the next person who comes to do the job as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and if I can come in on that one, the time to have that conversation with your employer isn't while you're sat at the foot of a ladder by phone or by VHF. And the best time to have that conversation is back in the office. And we in CHIRP really push this stop work authority. And actually, we really, really encourage pilots to go and have those conversations so that they know, as Ari said, you know, people put themselves under a lot of self-imposed pressure. And of course, if you know that your employer is going to support you if you say no to climbing a vessel, then that's one large pressure that you've removed from yourself. And that in itself will make you, quite often, knowing you've got the ability to say no, sometimes actually lessens the number of times you're likely to have to say no.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really a conversation for the middle of the night. It's something to have discussed well in advance.
Yeah, I mean, there are occasions we do get thoughts from people who say, you know, I'm not allowed to say no, I almost have to do this. Or at least that's how it comes across. That's their genuine belief. Now, whether that's truly the case, I can't say. But that would be a shame if that were the case, that pilots were being put under an inappropriate pressure to continue with the task, even if they could see that it was dangerous.
Yeah. So I just want to go back to this issue of prosecutions, because I know we're not really focusing on, you know, a blame game in terms of looking for solutions. But it's interesting that AMSA have taken quite a hard line, haven't they, in terms of pursuing this? And do you think this is helpful in terms of at least raising the profile of this issue? Andrew, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I thought you'd pick on me. I'm Mr. Carrots. So we're the people who look for trying to make people do the right thing because they want to, because it's a virtual behavior. But I would be naive to pretend that there isn't a place for the stick as well. And that there will be organizations, persons who are going to do the bare minimum they can to get past and no more. And if their attitude to improving safety is not what you want as a regulator, then you have the option to take them to court. And I guess there's more to the story than we know about. And I guess AMSA thought quite long and hard before they brought that prosecution. And we've talked about the numbers, and the number of prosecutions actually is fewer than the number of really quite serious accidents. So you know, is the balance right yet? I'm not sure. The Australians are always quite bullish. They issue some really quite strong messaging to shipping companies about the behaviour they expect of ships visiting Australian waters and Australian ports. That's been around for quite a long time. So the fact that they're now operationalising that with the odd prosecution, that's all part of the same trajectory. And it sends a message that you get it wrong, then you could end up in court. The US Coast Guard are pretty robust as well. But I think the other thing that we must focus on is making sure that people understand the benefits of doing it right as well, so that they do it voluntarily without just simply fear of being prosecuted.
Yeah. And I think nobody on those vessels wants an accident to happen to their pilot coming on board. They don't want that to happen. So the education thing's got to be such an important part of it, hasn't it? Because it's not a deliberate thing, is it? I always want to ask all of the guests a final question. And I would like to ask each guest in turn, if you would tell me, if there was one change that you could make and it would make a difference, what would be that one thing that could make a difference? And I'm going to start with you, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for that. So one thing that would make a difference, I think, would be a more open conversation between the port authorities and harbour masters and their pilots, to really reinforce the backing that the pilots have to say no, say stop, when they're not happy with the arrangements. I think there's an awful lot of pressure that people put on themselves. You know, I'm a professional mariner, I've done this before, I can do it, the ship's got to get in if it misses its slot. You know, even if it's not overt pressure from the company, people put pressure on themselves to do the job that they're paid to do. And I think a really open conversation between those people who are paying the money and those people who are doing the task to say, no, if you're not happy and you say I'm not going, we're going to back you. And so I think that would be a really good start.
Ari, would you like to tell me what you think could be the one change, if you could only make one change? What would be the one thing that could make a difference?
Safety should be in everybody's blood and system. I'm trying to work on that because my goal is to get everybody home vertically and not horizontally. You got to come home exactly the way as you left in the morning or in the evening to go to work.
I like that. Adam?
Well, I've gone last. So, of course, the two answers I would have given have obviously gone. No, I agree with both of those answers. But for me, I think safety isn't just a conversation that happens between individuals. It needs to be done right from the start of that, or even before that vessel's life begins. So I would raise the knowledge of the requirements amongst ship designers to make sure that they build compliant vessels and at least give the pilots a fighting chance of being able to board a compliant pilot ladder in the future.
Good. Well, thank you. I think that's a really good overview and a deep dive into safety for pilots.
There are links to all of those resources that we've talked about in the show notes. And remember that it is very easy to report to either MAIB or CHIRP if you see anything that concerns you while you're working at sea. So that's the end of our watch. I'm going to ring the bell. We're leaving the bridge. Ari's checked all of our arrangements, so I'm a lot happier now as I go down that ladder and we head back to shore. Great.